Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz, live from the Kintec studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. Now joining us from NHL.com and InGoal Magazine, he is a presentation of White Rock Hyundai. He is Kevin Woodley. Woodley, what's going on, man?
Not much. Just got the White Rock Hyundai Tucson pulled over on the side of the road here so I could talk safely to you guys.
Very responsible. Thank you.
On my way to Leafs practice because one of the two teams involved tomorrow is practicing today. So,
Do you drive a plug-in there?
What's that?
Your Hyundai. Is it a plug-in?
My Hyundai.
Yeah. What was that?
It's not currently a plug-in. No. I'm in a gas one right now. I've been in plug-ins before. My wife has the plug-in hybrid. Santa Fe, so best of both worlds, gas and electric.
Shocking, because you always get the plug-in.
Oh, really well done. So I go from criticizing you for not getting the sponsor's name right to like just like I feel like it's like one of those Wiser's moments. I'm tipping the glass. That was well
slow
done.
Slow clap. Kevin, we got to talk Thatcher. 950 across his last four starts. Looks like he's looking like Thatcher Demko again, huh?
Yeah, for the most part, right? Like, and last night, like, there's two sides to it, right? That was a lot of vintage Thatcher, and it's how the hell did you get out-expected gold by a 2-1 margin by the San Jose Sharks? Mm-hmm. Like, they were almost 5 expected goals last night, 12 Ooh. High dangers.
Ooh.
And
it felt
that
like
was
it.
The definition of a stolen win.
Yes.
And frankly,
I thought Colorado was, too.
Yeah, no, it was not to that
Colorado?
Degree.
You thought it was a stolen win?
Or which was the... Which
Nashville.
Was,
you're Nashville. Getting, them, you're
Nashville.
Getting them confused.
I am. I'm getting Nashville and Colorado mixed up. I thought Nashville was a stolen win.
Yeah, the Preds are... Preds were like... Yeah, I mean, yeah. So it was. Seven high danger and 3 expected goals. But nothing like last night. Mm-hmm. Last night was like Bruce Boudreaux, bullets in your teeth stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't look the same. It wasn't all off the rush and stuff like that. But, you know...
But it was a lot off the rush.
Yeah, and we haven't seen the numbers this skewed right in a while. And at the end of the day, what better time than to have your number one goaltender playing like your number one goaltender again? And it's been a few games now, and I kind of feel like I got lucky in that I pointed out after the Edmonton game, as lopsided as the score was and as much as that game was over early, I actually thought he was really good in it. Like, to my eye, it felt like in the second period he found something, and then you know, and that after the Colorado game, he talked about knowing where his game was at and maybe not the results not looking that way based on the results to everyone else. So maybe it was even before then. Maybe it was even during the first period against Edmonton. And nobody, including myself, would have been able to recognize it because he was just under siege the whole time. And the goals that he did give up were really no chancers. So, at the end of the day, whenever it was rediscovered, it is back almost entirely. The one caveat would be we see it about once a game where, the entries into the post just a little bit off and, hey, that's natural. It's going to happen. This is a process to getting back to peak powers Demko. And let's be honest, like peak powers Demko is one of the best in the world, arguably last year the best. So there's going to be pieces that come later than others, and that's one. We even saw it early in the San Jose game. Like, misses his right post, ends up sort of awkwardly resetting himself and then making a tough blocker save in tight that I think probably is an even easier save if not for that initial missed entry. And we've talked about it before throughout this process. Like, entries and exits off the post are what, like 5 or 6 goals they've cost him, you know, either off dead angles or on plays made from behind that or below the goal line into the middle that we're just not used to seeing. So as incredible as he's been, imagine what it looks like when that last step gets taken.
With what, like, are there areas in particular? I know we saw him get beat a lot. Long distance wrist shots were sort of an issue as he was finding his rhythm, allowing goals from post integration stances, the reverse VH. In particular, were sort of areas. Is there something you've seen him clean up?
Well, like I said, to me, that when I'm talking about entries and exits off the post, that latter part, that's the same thing you're talking about there. Cleaner, but still not to what we expect from Thatcher Demko. To me, it's just, you know, vision is leading everything again, and the pace that comes with that. there were people reaching out and like, oh, he looks slow, you know, early in the comeback. Doesn't look slow anymore.
No.
And even on the extended laterals where...
Yeah, like, you know, the Macklin like Celebrini almost... chance with 5 minutes to go. I don't even know if Celebrini got a shot for it because it was clearly going wide, but the explosiveness post to post there, that was vintage.
Yeah, and the explosiveness is accompanied with attachment, right? Like, he's visually attached to the puck and he has access to his hands. It's not just a sprawl, right? Like, a lot of guys will make a big push. He's making a big push. He's got eyes on the puck. He's got rotation, and he's got access to his hands. And we saw that in the Colorado game on a couple of those backdoor chances, right? Like, this isn't just sprawling, you know, the speed with which he plays. It's a visual attachment leading it that allows him to get a glove on a puck off the back door, where a lot of goalies, even good goalies, maybe they get a push. Maybe it's somewhere near as explosive as his, but not many of them have that connection and that access to the hands in the first place, but then the ability to sort of, you know, track pucks and use the glove as effectively as he does. And we saw it last night too, a couple times, like, you know, even bang, bang plays in tight where he gets fully extended and the puck ends up off his pad, but you can see that hand in support, the drill that they still do and used to do under Ian Clark and still do, you know, with Marco Turinius, where it's not just sticking a leg out. The hands are there. The gloves are there. There's vertical support to make, you know, saves if the shooter's able to elevate. So it's a lot of the things that we came to associate with what made him special are more evident more often of late. And that bodes really well for a team who, you know, we can kind of be guilty of quickly forgetting, also has another really good option in goal. And for a team that's got ground to make up after the start they had, man, I've already had people ask me, who's the number one? I don't care. If you got two, that's a good thing. Like, a lot of time people say, if you don't have one, you don't. If you say you got two number ones, it means you don't. Well, in this case, you could argue it really means you do.
Yeah, and that's one of the interesting things now for the rest of the season, right? Because as you mentioned, obviously they have Kevin Lankinen, who's played really well. Now Thatcher Demko seems to be rounding into form, and there's all these competing interests they're going to have to balance. You're in the thick of a playoff race, so you're pretty desperate for 2 points night in, night out at this point. You know, you want to give Demko the reps to keep rounding into form, but you also want to keep him as fresh and healthy as possible. You want to keep Kevin Lankinen healthy and keep getting him starts, but he's also a pending UFA, so that's another wrinkle. I mean, how do you kind of expect to see this shake out, and how do you expect them to see them approach it for the remainder of the season?
Honestly, I don't have the answer. I'm kind of curious to see how they do. I think in the short term, it's more Demko, just because, listen, he's been through so much. And I was guilty of underestimating just how hard this would be, because we'd seen him come back from injuries before and find his form quicker than this. And that was probably too dismissive of just how tough this was, the amount of time missed, the challenge, you know, coming back. Your goalie coach has been a big part of building your game, isn't there anymore, even though the guy that's replacing him has a lot of the similar philosophies and tools. Like, there's a lot of things that got thrown at him throughout this, and it was probably unrealistic to expect it to happen quickly. And so now that it has happened, you would think they would want to build on it. I could argue that this Four Nations break couldn't come at a worse time for him, right? Like, getting off the ice after all this, but at least he'll be able to go into it in a positive mindset about the way things are going. That's the positive side. But, you know, you'd think he'd want to keep building. And so at least Lankinen will have the chance to be on the ice more with Finland and sort of keep himself fresh. He's more used to this role. And so even if it goes in, starts to swing more to a 3-1 ratio to Demko, and there's got to be some wisdom here in terms of not overplaying him. So even if we get to a 3-1 ratio, like, you can still get the best out of Kevin Lankinen. As a matter of fact, you know, it was 2 years in Nashville that had me, you know, yelling from the rooftops on July 1st, somebody sign this guy. His numbers on an adjusted save percentage basis were actually better than what we've seen here in Vancouver. What he's proven here is that he can be a number one for long stretches of time, not just in relief. But you know he can do that and play at that level, and even higher level, playing whether it's once a week or once every 8 or 9 days. So you're not going to lose that. The question is more to me, how do you manage to get the best out of Demko, and you slot Kevin Lankinen in relative to that, so long as Demko keeps playing well?
With Demko generally and where we're at, because, you know, I think the split, how they manage it, what they're evaluating there, whether it's Lankanen's expiring status or the fact that Demko becomes extension eligible after this season. I think it makes sense. We're all kind of in agreement. Like, they got to see what sort of load Demko can bear here down the stretch. But given what you know about the injury, returning from it, is there an extent to which, like, is there a line here in terms of where usage, heavy usage becomes overusage that they have to be careful about?
That's a really good question. I don't have all that information in terms of knowing, you know, how much that injury, if at all, is a factor in any of this now.
Right.
Right? Like, is he 100% it's not a factor? Or as we heard so much reported, you know, while he was out, that it was, you know, more the kind of thing that's going to be a part of what he has to deal with moving forward forever and ever. Amen. I don't have that answer. I would suggest that short of that information changing your formulation, it would kind of just be the way it maybe should have been last year before ultimately led to an injury, is we should never get to a point where over a 20 game sample, he's at a 65 start pace, right? Like that's where they played him at coming out of the All-Star break last year until the injury. It was on a 65 start pace. And the argument was made at the time that it was too much. And ultimately, it ended up being too much. And maybe he would push back, and maybe he would disagree with that, and maybe he wants to prove that he can play more than that. And maybe they feel like they can see it, or they need to see it, as you said. But at a time when very few in the entire league do, given the injury history, it would just seem to make sense that that's sort of the realm you don't touch. And whether that's, you know, anything more than 2 weeks or 3 weeks, if you're at that pace, it's too much. I'd kind of use that as a high watermark, and maybe it's over the course of a month. Maybe in a shorter term, if you need them for four in a row, and yeah, that's an 82 game pace in that four game sample, right? Like that, you know, that's okay. But I think you need look no further than last year to sort of give yourself a threshold for, you know, how many is too many.
Woodley, moving away from the goaltenders for a bit here, you know, the Canucks get the win 2-1 in San Jose last night. Obviously, as you're laying out, you know, not an inspiring performance. They gave up a ton and they didn't generate a lot either. And, you know, one of the players responsible for that is Elias Pettersson. Just nothing going on for the Canucks when he was on the ice last night, 5-on-5 or the power play, really. And, you know, we've seen him struggle for a while now, but that felt to me like kind of a new low this season for Elias Pettersson. Do you agree that was a standout negative performance for him this year?
Yeah, you know what? I mean, it sure seems like it, and I can see how we get to that conclusion. I'll be honest, I have trouble judging the ones I watch on TV versus the ones
fair
at home, right? You see the game at a different level. You see things away from the puck, especially, obviously, for me, on the goaltending. Like, they're often out of the frame, and I find just in general it's a little different. There's been a lot of talk about the speed and the lack of it, and the bursts that aren't there based on the NHL edge data like they used to be when he was playing well. A lot of talk about injury. And no, Thomas, I heard you say he doesn't look right. And I agree with all those things. Intermixed with it, though, is, and I hate to go talk it on this and go cliche because we've heard it so much, but it's not just, you know, it's not just a lack of speed when he is moving. It's just the amount of times he's not, right? And there's just too much disengagement is how it feels from above in terms of attacking and assertiveness. And, you know, again, quote unquote, moving your feet. Like, you're not going to get to any speed bursts if you're coasting as often as he seems to be doing. And that, you know, obviously I'm not the first to say that. Obviously they've said it internally. And maybe that's just a confidence thing, right? Like, when to attack and having that faith, you know, bro, do your deeks. Attack plays, attack players, attack defenses. And maybe if you don't feel like you have the speed, maybe you don't have the confidence to do that as often as you used to. But we just don't see enough of that assertive engagement like we used to see regularly. And whether that's injury, whether that's a lack of speed, whether that's a lack of confidence, whatever it may be, there are people making a lot more than the three of us in charge of finding and fixing it. And if they don't, It seems pretty clear that more nights like last night are ultimately a problem given the paycheck involved.
Kevin, if you were to be given a ballot and invited to vote on the fictional award I'm about to invent called the Midseason Vezina, who would your three finalists be and who would ultimately win?
Oh, wow. Would we be like, when was the midseason? Are we doing it right now? Are we doing
January 1st? The Four Nations face-off break, but weirdly, your ballot has to be in with like 40 games still to be played across the league.
Well, and the reason I ask that is because the calendar turned to 2025, and the answer was easy. It was a no-brainer. It was Connor Hellebuck. And almost since that point, his numbers have kind of slowly, maybe a little quietly, fallen off a cliff. I mean, he heads into the Four Nations below expected from a save percentage standpoint since January 1st.
Mm.
Like the opposite of what he was doing before that. And even before that, when I look at the number at ClearSight, there was a certain environment factor that was contributing to his high raw numbers overall. And so I could have made the argument even then, as much as he would have been the obvious choice, and I believe the choice of general managers, I could have made a math argument for Logan Thompson. And that's actually only increased since then. So by the time we get to the end of the year, the way Sorokin's coming right now and catching both of them, like he's passed Hellebuck from a goal saved standpoint. And the 1-2-3 right now would be Logan Thompson, Igor Shesterkin, and Ilya Sorokin, just based on the numbers. And given what Logan Thompson has done tip to tail, even in a smaller sample size, still a big enough sample size, you know, when we look at Linus Ullmark winning it a couple of years ago, that I think he qualifies, he would probably be my pick.
Wow.
I mean, and the irony here is we head into Four Nations. There are three Canadians.
And he ain't there. And they're not there.
Adjusted save percentage. Yeah, but it's not just him. It's Mackenzie Blackwood and it's Darcy Kemper. Three Canadians in the top 10 and none of them are on the roster.
Well, and also interesting, you talk about Hellebuck slipping a little bit, and I think we've all looked at Team USA, and look, they've got a lot of talent everywhere, but goaltending has been their big edge. Is there a little bit of maybe a crack in the foundations for Team USA going into the Four Nations?
I think that there is, like, Connor Hellebuck has the ability to instill a belief, like teammates. You know, like, it sounds cliched, but, like, when he's back there, there's a certain faith that comes with it and a certain belief if we do our job, he'll do his. And he's a guy that can get into the heads of opponents, and in a short tournament, he actually could end up being the MVP of the whole thing. You know, just because it slid a little in Winnipeg over the last little while. Like, he still is one of the world's best goaltenders. There's a reason he has two Veznas and could still win a third this year. But interestingly enough, I suggested at the start of the season that I would give strong consideration to have Thatcher Demko on my team if I was the Americans, because we know what peak powers Demko looks like. And not only is it at the level of a Hellebuck at his best, but it's different. It's more dynamic. Like, Hellebuck makes saves with his brain. And there's a level of athleticism that I honestly don't know. Is it going to be required at this tournament or not? I'm really curious to see what style of play we get out of this, especially mid-season. But there are things that Demko does that I'm not sure the other guys on that list, and Swayman to an extent too can do it. But here we are, like, for most of the season, I'm like, wow, that was a really bad take, Woodley. It's like really bad take because he struggled so much, and you know, Swayman's found his game a little bit here. But over the last five games, as we see Thatcher rediscover that form, if nothing else, he's safe my take a little bit. And this is the challenge of the whole tournament, right? Like, Canada names three goalies. None of them since January 1st are above expected. And none of them are in that top 10 list of Canadian goalies that I mentioned. Like, picking goalies so early is a problem. I'm not so sure that Thatcher Demko wouldn't end up starting games the way he's playing the last 5 days for USA.
So with that in mind, I wanted to ask you about Canada's goalie situation as well. It's Binnington, Hill, and Montembeault, and I think the expectation has been Binnington will kind of get first crack at being the starter, but if you were making the decisions, I mean, who would you be riding with going into this tournament?
I actually think it might be Aiden Hill that gets first crack.
All right.
And as much
it
as
should be.
Jordan Binnington...
Let's be real, it should be.
Well, and as much as Jordan Binnington was full value for the selection based on his previous 5 years, like, he was top 10 in the entire league over the last 5 years combined in adjusted save percentage. And that counts. Like, that's a track record, and yes, it includes a cup. The reality is it just hasn't been there this season. I don't know why. I don't have an answer to it. St. Louis has not been a great environment in the past, and he's overcome it, you know, through some ups and downs. But overall, the numbers have always risen to that top 10 level and better than most people outside of the market that watch him on a regular basis ever understood, frankly. It was kind of one of those, like, you know, the eye test is lying to you. The narrative about Binnington was not true. It was more about the team being terrible defensively and him bailing them out for like 5 years. But it just hasn't happened this year. And so whether it's the numbers on the season as a whole or what he looks like when he's at his best, and the challenge right now is Aiden Hill hasn't been at his best of late, but there was a stretch through December where you saw it and you're like, okay, he's the guy. And when you look at where he's at overall this season, and you look at the fact that there are, you know, Pete DeBoer, Bruce Cassidy on that coaching staff, even though the goalie coach is from St. Louis, I have a hunch it might be Aiden Hill that gets first crack at this.
Woodley, always appreciate your time. Enjoy the tournament next week. I think it should be a blast. And as you said, going to be interesting to see what the style of play and all that looks like and who gets the reps in net for Canada. Thanks for doing this, man.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it as well. But first, the Leafs.
Yes, of course. Got to get through that first.
But first, the real Team Canada.
Oh, wow.
There you go.
Canada's team before we see Team Canada next
Thomas
week.
Thomas making his bid for national appearances.
Thank you, Woodley.
See you guys.
That is Kevin Woodley on Sportsnet 650, brought to you by White Rock Hyundai. Visit the showroom on King George in White Rock or whiterockhyundai.com.
25% tariffs on Canadian save percentage.
No, delayed for a month.
Not when it comes to goalies. Goalies are being taxed like steel and softwood lumber.
Man, the three goalies in the top 10 by his numbers and none of them on the roster.
Oh,
that's unfortunate.
That's the most Hockey Canada thing of all time.
Do not love it.
No, it's
do not
so,
love it. Don't that's care
like,
for it.
That's like, just like, hey, what if we built a World Juniors team and featured none of our top scorers across any of the CHL leagues?
Yeah.
And you know what? I didn't like that one either.
No.
Wasn't a fan.
And it didn't work out.
Heck no.
Did not work out.
Carisdale's Andrew Crystal. Did you see that stretch he went on, by the way? He had 33 points in 9 games.
I just love calling him Carisdale's Andrew Crystal.
Why?
I don't know why. It cracks me up.
We do it with
not
all
just
of them.
Vancouver.
Lynn Valley's Connor Bedard.
That's true.
Port Moody's.
Well, Port Moody is a municipality. It's not just a neighborhood.
I don't know the neighborhoods in Port Moody. Do you?
Heritage Mountain.
I don't know if he's from there.
I don't know either. I can't tell you. I can't tell you where Ken Johnson is from.
I'll have to ask.
That's the only one I know, though.
Yeah. And then just to troll the people in the Valley, Vancouver's Zach Benson.
Vancouver's very own Zach Benson. From East Vancouver, Zach Benson.
From definitely in the metropolitan area of Vancouver.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here. As mentioned, the Canucks are taking on the Toronto Maple Leafs on Hockey Night in Canada, their last game before the Four Nations tournament gets going. So we will talk to Justin Cuthbert from the Fan 590 next about that one. As mentioned earlier, no Dimitri this week. He's got the week off. So we'll have an open segment to wrap things up at 1:30. You can text in some of your thoughts and questions, your takes, 650-650 to the Dumbor. Somebody just texted in Anmore, and I read it.
Dumbor.
I was reading Anmore at the same time.
Dumbor Lumber.
Dumbor. Dumbar Lumber. Text slide, 650-650. We'll take a break. More Canucks talk on the other side. Sportsnet, 650.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz here. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Keep sending your thoughts in now. The Canucks play the Toronto Maple Leafs tomorrow at Rogers Arena on Hockey Night in Canada. Final game before the Four Nations. And now joining to chat about that game and the Leafs season.
Before we let Cuthbert on the line, the Vancouver Canucks have announced that a trade. They've traded defenseman Mark Friedman to the Nashville Predators for future considerations.
All right, there you go. Blockbuster deal, sending Mark Friedman to the Nashville Predators. We can touch on that more in a bit. But now joining us, as mentioned, from the Fan 590 in Toronto, he is Justin Cuthbert. Justin, thanks for doing this, man. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Big deal there.
Big deal.
You guys could boot me at any time.
Slightly smaller deal than we've been used to in these parts over the last week or so.
Justin, what's your take on this massive trade?
I gotta be honest. I know more about Elliot Friedman than Mark Friedman, but the aggressiveness of Jimmy Rutherford, just getting things done, getting the ball rolling. You always have to appreciate it, because even if it's small, it's something for you guys to sink your teeth into. So I'll tune into the breakdown once I get off the air.
You don't need to do that. Don't worry.
You definitely do, Mark Friedman. You should familiarize yourself with his game. He's good.
There you go. Nashville going to turn their season around. All right. So the Leafs come into town tomorrow and, you know, by points percentage, first have the best points percentage in the Atlantic. And yet, is it fair to say that I think, like, I sense just following it from afar, a fair amount of skepticism about this team from fans in the market? Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I don't know if skepticism is the perfect word, but it's definitely a feeling of, not even a lack of confidence. It's just that there's a real understanding that clearly this team isn't fully formed. I mean, there's obvious issues that need to be addressed, and yet they're in the position they're in where, yeah, it's very competitive in the Atlantic Division, but it should be their division to lose based on what we've seen and the health that they're getting and the idea that they might be adding ahead of the trade deadline. I think this team has played some pretty mediocre hockey over the last couple of months. There's been times where they've dug their heels into the ground and played pretty well. But this hasn't been like previous seasons where it's looked a little bit more encouraging or just looked better on balance. And part of that is moving to a Berube system, which at some points when it's not going well can look pretty ugly, but does amount to accumulating a decent amount of points. So the Maple Leafs are definitely banking on the fact that for the first time in a very long time, they have two beyond competent goaltenders, two stars in Joseph Woll and Anthony Stolarz, who returned last night. But if that goaltending was just a tad bit worse, it'd be easier to poke holes in what they're doing.
When I watch them play, Justin, they just look slow. It's so weird to say that about a team that I remember as like the track meet Leafs in those years where they were battling Boston, losing to Boston in the first round year after year. But they look slow. They generate very little with pace off the rush when I watch them play. I actually think it's one of the reasons why Vancouver hangs tough with them now, because team speed's how you really crush the Canucks, and I don't know that the Leafs have it.
Yeah, like speaking of an older team, it's definitely a team that just doesn't have the supporting cast. Like there is, and this is part of the turnover thing that's been going on, and Brad Schilling been trying to make his stamp on the roster. But a lot of this is trying to cycle out the guys who just didn't work, who just don't offer much, at least from an offensive standpoint. But were the guys Kyle Dubas tasked to just try to break even and let the top four guys dominate? I don't think, like you compare it to Berube teams, that St. Louis Blues team, maybe they weren't the fastest in the world, but boy, they could put pressure on you and make it feel at times overwhelming with the way that they checked and the way that they could forecheck. The Maple Leafs just aren't built that way. So the guys that aren't, you know, their core four guys plus Matthew Nyes, they just don't have much to offer out there. And those guys aren't particularly fast. Those guys don't bring much in the way of secondary offense. And when the Maple Leafs are reduced to, you know, playing with three of their four top guys, oftentimes they're trying to spread it out and figure out ways to maximize that offense. And it just looks incongruent at times. But you're right. It's an older team. It's relying on guys for secondary offense that haven't been able to prove this year that they can provide it. And it is a departure from what was. And I'm not necessarily believing that it's much worse, because at times they can play a really sound defensive game and look really good in their structure. But the track meet offense, yeah, those days are over. And it's just about, you know, trying to fill in the personnel to make sure that the direction that they're headed can actually be fulfilled by the roster that Berube has in his hands.
Austin Matthews, you know, coming off the incredible 69-goal season last year, and, you know, obviously he's missed time with injury, kind of mysterious injury stuff going on with him at certain points. You know, his shooting percentage is 12.7, well below his career average this year. Normally he's such a dangerous finisher. Where's his game trending right now for the Leafs? And, you know, obviously this is relevant going into the Four Nations next week as well.
Yeah, it's leveled off a little bit. You're right. It hasn't been a typical Matthews season. He hasn't been the dangerous shooter that we are accustomed to as much. And, you know, there shouldn't really be an excuse, because Matthew Nyes has really grown this year, has turned into, on occasion, an absolute rock star, and he's still dealing with inconsistencies in his game. But when you're playing with Mitch Marner, who's arguably been the MVP of the team, and Matthew Nyes, like, there should be the expectation that an Austin Matthews season would be at least, you know, one of his above the median or above the average that he's been able to produce at this level. But the injury was the injury. The injury took him out for basically the entire month of November. And at times he's looked fully formed and fully able and not affected at all by what he was dealing with. And at times it looks like he's a little slower. It doesn't look like he's got that pop. The release doesn't look like it once was or what it is when it's at its best. And I think he's just dealing through the after effects of that injury. But I think that's probably giving him the benefit of the doubt a little bit too much, because the expectation, if you're paid all that money and you're in the lineup and you're telling us that everything's cool, that we'd see a little bit more of what we're accustomed to. And it's just been, frankly, a down Matthews season for a multitude of reasons.
What's the conversation like around Mitch Marner? I think he's the most criticized Toronto sports athlete since, trying to think of who would be more criticized. Jose Bautista?
No, people loved Jose Bautista.
Yeah, no, but he was always criticized.
Yeah.
Wasn't he?
Not really.
You don't think so?
I don't know. Justin, you're there. Was Jose Bautista a target for major criticism?
I thought so.
The media liked going at it with Jose Bautista.
Yeah.
But I think... I mean, he's a made man in the city, so it is easy to figure or to forget about the bad times and when the team wasn't having success before 2015. But I would say certainly in the post 2015 afterglow, he was pretty untouchable in the city. Yeah.
Yeah.
But as for Marner, not untouchable in the city.
No, no, absolutely
well, okay,
not.
So
what's the comp? What's the comp? What, most criticized Toronto sports athlete since Brian McCabe. Tomáš Cabrelé.
Cabrelé, yeah.
Yeah, Cabrelé.
Jake Gardner, but again...
But Jake Gardner wasn't good enough.
Yeah, he's not good enough.
Yeah.
You're right.
Jake Gardner was like, in Vancouver, Nikolai Goldobin used to fill hours and hours of sports talk radio, but it's like, that's what people do when they're covering or talking about bad teams. You like latch on to the young player who maybe is okay, but probably isn't good enough, and just like grind him down. No, I don't think Gardner qualifies. What about a Raptors player? Rudy Gay? Anyway, sorry. Mitch Marner, always get in the gears. Yeah. And now he's approaching UFA, and it feels like, I don't know, doesn't this team need to keep him?
It's a tough one. I mean, the problem with Mitch Marner is that he is hell-bent on making it as difficult as possible. Like, I concluded last year thinking, you know, there's no way they can't make a change. There's no way a guy who played so poorly and is expected to do so much for the group could just go into July 1, sign a contract, and act like nothing had happened. And I felt like, you know, with all the reporting over the summer that they were going to look to move him, that it wasn't going to work out in Toronto, that there was avenues to change the DNA of this team, that slowly dissipated, and the conversation just turned to sort of this inevitability of him returning on whatever deal he wanted. And I felt like I was taking crazy pills throughout that whole process, because I'm not sure how you could look blindly at the results and just sign up to continue to pay him more and then turn around to give Matthews more, because of course you're giving Matthews more. And when the salary cap reaches $115 million in a couple seasons, they're going to be paying Marner $15 million and Matthews $20 million, and it's going to be the same story over and over and over again. Just with Marner, I cannot rubber stamp a decision to sign him to a deal that is an unbelievably team-friendly before we see what happens in these playoffs. Because if it is a return to that kind of sulky, lack of accountability, no impact that we've seen from Mitch Marner over many postseasons now, and you give him the world like you've given him already, I mean, I'm questioning exactly what this organization is trying to accomplish. Is it about just the business and making sure that you continue to profit off this core group, or are you trying to win hockey games? I think Mitch Marner can change the perception, but I think he's got one real shot to do it, and that's playing like Mitch Marner in the playoffs and when it matters the most for this team. And yet it feels like, regardless of results, he'll just get what he wants, and the same dance. We'll all be doing the same dance this summer.
It's just, you know, for how many years has the conversation been change up the core four, trade one of the core four there, right? They're making so much money. They haven't performed. You got to trade one. And now, you know, Austin Matthews he's gotten a new contract, big raise. Nylander's gotten a new contract, big raise. You know, John Tavares obviously won't get a raise, but it seems like it's trending in him coming back for on a much team friendlier deal. If Marner stays and gets maybe a raise or just another huge contract, like, is there any appetite for that from Toronto fans to roll it back with those four guys making a huge chunk of the salary cap again?
It has been flows. Like, it'll be really, the vitriol will be at an all-time high in May if they don't amount to anything in April. But around this time, people, you know, they've seen 41 games or so of Mitch Marner and Austin Matthews and William Nylander playing well, and you start to forget about it. And the cycle just repeats itself. This is what's been happening in Toronto for many, many years now. But the thing is, like, yeah, the salary cap is going up, and everyone's like, okay, you can fit Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner and Matthew Nyes, and maybe you can add a piece because the salary cap is going up. But it's like, okay, all this new financial flexibility is going to let everyone else improve greatly if they so choose, while the Maple Leafs just get to keep their team together that continues to fail every single year. So I eventually, my hope was Brad Treliving was going to look at things differently. And I guess my first sort of take when he was brought in was that he was going to be the caretaker of what Brandon Shanahan wanted to do. And I think Brandon Shanahan wants this core four to work just as much as Kyle Dubas did. And now I'm starting to feel, given the reporting this year, that Treliving is kind of that caretaker in that he's just keeping everyone in the fold and not making that big move as opposed beyond, you know, the coach and trying to play a different style of hockey. If it's, again, a repeated failure and Mitch Marner signs a massive ticket this summer, like, you really got to question whether or not anyone is willing or even allowed to make the big moves to actually change the results. And I think that'll be an immensely frustrating time in this city.
Justin, really appreciate the time. Enjoy the game tomorrow. Thanks for doing this.
Not a problem, guys. You enjoy it as well.
That is Justin Cuthbert from Fan 590 in Toronto weighing in on yet another season of should we keep the core four together or not discourse in Toronto.
And the Mark Friedman blockbuster.
And yes, weighing in. Well, not really. He declined to weigh in. Said he knew more about Elliot Friedman than Mark Friedman, which is fair.
Nah. Mark Friedman's good, man.
Mark Friedman, 28 games for the Canucks over the last two seasons and did his job very well in those 28 games. Did exactly what you wanted to see from a defender in that position. Of course, acquired midseason last year, gave them some really good minutes, played five games for them this year. You know, they have nine defensemen on the roster right now, and Mark Friedman was not one of them. So that right there tells you where he kind of sat on the depth chart. Now, I will say, if they're exploring trading Carson Soucy as well, and you've just traded Mark Friedman, a guy who you trusted to give you games coming up from the minor leagues, you know, if you do both of those before the trade deadline, that is actually a pretty significant hit to your defensive depth. And then you're starting to talk about turning to guys like
Cole McWard.
Yeah, your Cole McWards, your Kirill Kudryavtsevs, those guys who are not tested, really. I know McWard's played, but not tested truly at the NHL level.
Friedman, I think Friedman's good. Like, I think Friedman can move the puck well. I think he's uber competitive. I think he's smart defensively, and his results throughout his Canucks tenure were actually really, really good. Spiking in that sort of late October, early November stretch of 2023 where, you know, he played top 4 minutes with Ian Cole and was a big part of the like hashtag the start when the Canucks kind of shocked the world to open that campaign.
Mm-hmm.
They needed him. Like, they needed what he brought at a key moment. And, you know, behind the scenes, his level of engagement, the way that he practiced, the way that he sort of grinded away for this team behind the scenes, I think mattered too. I think helped set a culture. I think you need to have that element of who you are and what you are as a player. Training camp, he's like he's one of those final boss guys at training camp where he sets a pretty high level that you have to beat if you're gonna like crack
for a young player to come in and make it.
There's no gimmies if you've got guys like Mark Friedman going at you in battle drills, because they go at you hard and they're pretty good.
Yeah, he's kind of like the Phil DiGiuseppe on the blue line kind of thing, right?
Except without it, if he was like 3 inches taller. Because Phil DiGiuseppe looks like an NHL fourth liner at the very least, in a way that Mark Friedman, you know, doesn't look like your ideal. He's not ideal size for a third pair defenseman, right? Mm-hmm. Just period. If he was 3 inches taller, Rick Tocchet would never take him out of the lineup. I swear.
Yep.
Anyway, so it goes, so it is.
Hold on. One text I just wanted to read here from a second ago was, this one. Can you explain future considerations, please? What would Nashville trade? Oh, we saw this earlier with Daniel Sprong as well.
Considerations. It's free. It's free. You're not allowed to type no return on the paperwork. Like, fundamentally, that's what's up. Now,
you know what they call that in law? Right, like a contract?
A
peppercorn.
A peppercorn.
You have to at least give the other person a peppercorn in exchange for something, for it to be a legally binding contract.
Like when I sold my sister my old Jeep for a dollar.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It's like something has to pass the other way.
Right. So a peppercorn, it is fundamentally a peppercorn, which I love. I'm so excited to know that. Thank you, Jamie.
You're welcome.
But there's sometimes little things in it.
Like, baseball, you'll see, I don't know about in hockey, but in baseball, sometimes you'll see it's like future considerations, and it's like you can choose from this list of five guys or something.
Like that.
You know
it's
what I
like
mean?
That.
Yeah.
It's you know, non-player personnel consideration. So like
cash
or something like that, or renovation to our minor league facility break room, or like some, you know, silly thing. That there's a scene in
Does
Moneyball.
Does that actually happen?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
There's a scene in Moneyball, right? Where it's like, and I want them to cover the cost of the vending machine for players, right? Like that sort of thing. That does sometimes happen. There are sort of minor little agreements like that, but fundamentally a peppercorn. Now, there actually is a hockey story here that's more interesting than Canucks, than the end of the Mark Friedman era of Vancouver Canucks hockey. By shedding Friedman, okay, the Canucks open up a contract slot, now have 4 vacant spots, which, depending on which way this season goes, is actually pretty interesting. Not only in terms of college free agent recruiting, potentially, but also in terms of making some two-for-ones. If you're trading Brock Besser in a seller deal, but you still want to make the playoffs, right? Could you bring in 2 guys to try and aggregate what you were getting from Besser? Like, is there a world where the Canucks sell Besser at a certain price, take a portion of that return and trade for Jason Zucker, and take a portion of the, another portion of the return and add, you know, another forward?
Yeah.
Deepen their forward group even further, because I still think that's needed.
If you're asking if there's a chance that this management group trades a player and then turns around and flips those assets for something, I'll tell you. The answer is very much yes. They love few things more than doing that.
That is what they do. So I think the contract slot stuff matters here. Additionally, Friedman was on a 1-way contract, $775,000. Now, the Canucks also have Guillaume Brisebois on a 1-way contract, but typically speaking, like, this is not a team that has parked a lot of cash in the American League.
Usually
they've been pretty circumspect about that.
Yeah.
In contrast with the first season that Abbotsford ran, in which, you know, Nick Petan and Sheldon Dries and like all these expensive American League veterans dotting the roster. The Canucks have sort of gotten away from that. But Friedman was on a one way. Guillaume Brisebois is on a one way. Akito Hirose is on a one way. Yikes. Right? Like, I guarantee you, when they look at their balance sheet, given the way that they try to be efficient and sustainable in terms of managing the budget down in the American League, I guarantee you that Akito Hirose, 787K one way, like a full guaranteed NHL salary, is like, oh man. So shedding some money from there, does that position the club to do one of those things we sometimes see where a team takes on one of those expensive American League contracts as a method of like buying buying, effectively giving a team non-hockey value, but real value to juice a return. The most recent example of the Canucks doing this was Lane Peterson in the Ethan Bear trade.
Right.
That was a one-way contract guy, really struggled for the Canes at training camp. And so, you know, a fifth and we eat Lane Peterson's money, and that gets us Ethan Bear for freezies. Or for cheap.
For a five. For a fifth round pick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one way of going about it. So does shedding some money in the American League add to Vancouver's ability to go to some teams, you know, teams that are out of it, teams that are maybe a little more budget conscious, Buffalo, and potentially buy a player or at least leverage sort of their pockets?
Help
in
grease the wheels a little bit on a trade, on a larger trade,
in some
other way. Yeah.
Who's the most famous bought contract in Canucks history?
Who?
Brad Lukovic.
Oh, of course. Yeah, in the Christian Ehrhoff deal.
Take $1.5 million from the Sharks and bury it in the American League back when you could do that in full.
Now, who went the other way? Oh,
Daniel Ramey
and Patrick White. Yep. Yes. Very good.
I think that's underrated. I mean, it's not Naslin for Stojanov, but I think that's underrated
as
one of the
deal.
Great trades in Canucks history.
That was a really good deal. Yeah. I mean, I understand why it doesn't get put up there because, he played 2 years and then walked?
Yeah, but the Canucks won the President's
really
Trophy.
Really good.
Both
two
of those
two really good years.
Yeah.
Two really, really good years.
And he had like 50 points a year in
yes.
both of those seasons. So sick.
Yeah, that was a good trade. So there you go. And I think the contract slot side of it, right, where you're only allowed to have 50 guys under contracts and now they have 46, teams are always cautious about preserving some wiggle room there, especially going in to trade deadline. And, you know, people texting in, like, is this setting up another move? I don't think it's anything like that. I think it's just keeping their options open if they do want to do, as you said, some of those 2-for-1 swaps, whether it's a guy like Brock Besser going out, Carson Soucy going out. But then you're taking those assets and you're replacing them with potentially more players on your roster.
Soucy's the perfect example, right? Like, if you're the only justification, frankly, to moving Soucy now when his value's at a low ebb and he's struggling, right, is that you think you can allocate that money better.
Yep.
Right? Like, that's the only justification. The Besser one is just fascinating to me because I actually think there's some power that a team can accrue if they're in the position of both buyer and seller. Like, I actually think that's a really interesting, fun place to be in the market and one that offers some unique opportunity, especially because I do think this team's going to make the playoffs. You know, like one of the best examples we saw was Ryan Clough. The Sharks traded Ryan Clough and then turned around and used one of those seconds to buy Rafi Torres, who of course scored the key overtime winner in eliminating the Canucks in that playoffs. They did the same thing with Doug Murray. Doug Murray went for a pair of picks to the Penguins. I can't remember who they brought in, but they brought in someone else, a distressed value asset. Boom. Right. Like I think there's to think about where you're at and be in this nebulous middle point where you can try and calibrate the value of what you have, calibrate the value of what you want, take some of that value for later, but also, you know, like if you're not going to sign Besser, but you can bring in Jason Zucker and get a head start on retaining him on a contract extension, right? Like that's a faster guy. That's a productive goal scorer. Is he as good as Brock Besser? He's not, but is he going to be a lot cheaper than Brock Besser?
Yes.
Also, yes.
And you probably have some surplus assets left over as well, right?
Would I rather see this team keep Brock Besser? For sure. But if we're talking about the difference between 8 times 7 and four times four or five, do you think twice about what that value looks like, right? Especially if you're picking up a pick in the process that you can then spend elsewhere, right? So I think it's an interesting spot that they're in, and I sort of wonder if this Friedman deal at least hints at them beginning to clear the decks a bit to leverage both financial power and contract.
I don't think it's anything specific, like, oh, it's cooking because they did this, but it's just we're a month out from the trade deadline. So now's the time to get your ducks in a row so you can do things that arise, right? So you can take advantage of those possibilities. But it is Friday.
Yeah,
is that what you're going to say? I was thinking as well. It's Friday afternoon. They're like, we got to make a trade. It's that time. Let's make a trade.
I got the sense in making calls this morning, to be totally honest with you, that the Canucks seemed a little busier than usual.
Ooh.
No practice today, which is weird. Like, I would have expected a practice today in normal times. So I'm just saying, I'm not tipping anything, but my Spidey senses are certainly tingling after the Friedman deal.
All right. Interesting. We'll keep an eye on that, see if anything develops, although knowing the Canucks, they'll announce it once we're off the air if there is something going down. So we'll see. We'll see if anything happens
knowing
here.
The Canucks, they'll announce it at 10:30.
Yes, exactly. We'll see if anything else develops here, but we got one final segment coming up next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.
Great. I need one more thing. Soda. Yeah, I don't want my guys paying for soda. I want you to stock my machine for 3 years. I'm serious.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drantz. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. Final segment of the week. We can take some texts. I think you wanted to say something about Marcus Pettersson as well.
Oh,
what was that?
Yeah, no, just that I was reading McIntyre's interview with Patrick Alvin in which the Canucks were talking about Marcus Pettersson's leadership and that being a major reason. Now, I want to disclose my biases before this begins, which is that my eyes tend to glaze over anyway when people talk about leadership. Hockey people especially, just in the sort of idea of, oh, you know, this is something that you can always say that fans always eat up. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That, like, doesn't necessarily tell us a lot. Now, I think in Marcus Pettersson's case, from what I understand talking to people in and around the Penguins organization, I think his toughness, right, earns a lot of respect very quickly from teammates. I think you can see it. You can see how willing he is to take hits, to make plays. I think you can see that he's got that, you know, not like JT Miller style hockey toughness, but a different type of hockey toughness.
Yep.
That's just as important, a little more Tanev than Miller.
Sure.
Right. I think you can see that he's got that in spades. I can promise you that on the bench that ignites his teammates, right? Like, this isn't about Marcus Pettersson, but if a big reason for the way that this club values Marcus Pettersson is leadership, as opposed to what he does as a hockey player, there's an element of me that's like concerned, right? Like, I think the contract that they signed to Marcus Pettersson to, I think the acquisition, I think identifying a really good player, I think that's all true. Like, I'm here for that. But the idea of Marcus Pettersson as a leader in the organization's eyes makes me a little leery. Because, I mean, isn't this the same management group that traded Bo Horvat and decided to keep JT Miller? Isn't this the same team, you know, that built a core that imploded upon itself this season, right? That went from top 10 Stanley Cup odds entering the season to 50-1 today, largely as a result of character evaluation, right? Certainly, at least partly, mm-hmm. as a result of character evaluation. Like, to some extent, if this organization is making moves based on their assessment of the character of players, that like makes me nervous. I trust their ability to evaluate like defensemen and fit and hockey players. I'm nervous about their ability to evaluate character in the wake of what we've seen this season. So I just thought it was interesting that it was so upfront and out there. I almost wondered if the organization might cool it on that, because I actually think it leads us pretty naturally to questions of what sort of responsibility should this management team bear, you know, whether or not this was completely unique circumstances or what have you, just for not understanding the mix that they had in the room and some of the risks there when they were going all in on a core group that ultimately couldn't work together well enough to actually contend.
And for me, you know, character, leadership, culture, all those things.
By the way, we have a text coming in. The core that imploded was inherited. By the time, this is like Gillis inherited the core of the 2011 team, which is like true, but also by the time they're contending, like both Sedins are on new contracts that the previous management team negotiated. Luongo too, Kessler too. Like, you have moments where you decide whether or not you still own the core. The moment you trade Besser and sign Miller and then trade Pettersson, like, this was broken to the point where you had to buy it. Like, this is absolutely their core by the time they spend 2.5 years doing everything they can to support it and get it to the point of contending. Period. Like, this is their core. They stamped it and they built around it.
Now, I also think there's been some successes, as much as strange as it is to say, like Quinn Hughes, naming Quinn Hughes captain is a
genius,
home run.
Yes.
And on that front. But I think your underlying point of not with the Canucks or really with any team, culture and leadership and what was the other word you used? Culture, leadership, I don't know, whatever. There's another one that goes along with it. Anyways, it's important. Obviously, it's really, really important. It's also very, very difficult to evaluate. It's exceptionally difficult for us to evaluate from the outside. It's also really hard to evaluate for people who are living it day in, day out, right? And, you know, bringing in a player into the room and trying to project how they're going to affect the culture, how they're going to fit in, are they going to be a leader, all of those things, that's really, really hard to do. That doesn't mean that Marcus Pettersson isn't going to end up being a great leader or a really important voice for this team or bring that element of toughness in an important way. But I do think it's fair to kind of always regard that as something that's a question until you see it play out. Until you see it really play out in practice, you just don't know how that chemistry stuff is going to work out. So I think it's fair to point out, like, well, I mean, JT Miller was a big part of this leadership group, and we have no idea what was going on there, but obviously it did not work. What's going to be different this time? I think that would be a fascinating line of questioning at some point to get into with Canucks management. Has the way you evaluate character, that's the other word, character and leadership, has that changed at this point? Somebody texting in, leadership doesn't mean anything? No, it absolutely. It means a lot.
Yeah.
My point is that it's really difficult to evaluate how a guy is going to fit into the room.
And my point also is that I agree. It matters a lot. It matters a ton to me. But I'm nervous, given how we've seen this unfold, about this management group's ability to evaluate it. Just like I was nervous about, you know, Jim Benning always talked about character and on and on and on. And Jake Virtanen was like his handpicked first move of his tenure. And then they enabled and gave him just a brutal amount of opportunities, none of them earned, throughout his career. Right? He was never in shape. He was never, he never improved in the details of the game. And he just kept getting these opportunities and on. Like, this has been a decade now of us watching games and wondering about the character that this team, this organization is icing. Now, Rutherford and company only don't, you know, they don't bear any responsibility for what came before them, obviously. But I think already, you know, especially with how this season has gone, it just makes me nervous. I would rather hear them talk about hockey fit at the moment, especially because of how this season has gone and the fact that I think we've already seen enough to know, like, they invested in the wrong group of people in terms of the mix that this core had. Like, we've already seen that. Like, that's not arguable. That's not going to change in time.
The mix is a really good way of putting it. I think that's what I'm getting at as well. Even if you think you have a good read on individual player X, the mix is always kind of inherently unpredictable. And you're right. They made the wrong decision on the mix. We'll see how this, how, you know, trying to reshape that and remodel it going forward works out.
A good take, text in from goalie Mike. I think it's management putting a positive spin on what public perception is of a lack of leadership in the room in the wake of JT leaving. And I think that's fair, right? But then I think you need to say it more explicitly, right? We haven't done a good enough job of this, so we needed this guy. Right? As opposed to just doing the like wax poetic about the importance of leadership, given this group charging headlong into a pretty vital season for this organization, a season in which a lot of people expected them to level up significantly, that imploded due to character issues in the room.
On that question, or on a similar point, anyways, Dylan the G texts in, do you think the club should take the A away from Elias Pettersson? And I've seen that come up as a suggestion when JT Miller was still here. I saw a lot of people texting saying take the A's away from both of them, given the way they were playing, given the way we understood the issues between them were affecting the team. We could see it, how it was affecting the team on the ice. There's a part of me that says, well, if he's given performances like last night and... You know, the GM, Patrick Alvin, again yesterday, and we can talk a little bit about the what he had to say, you know, said, yeah, part of the issue has been his preparedness, while also saying that he thinks he's going to start putting the work in and do better. You know, you're saying this guy who's your highest paid player lacked preparedness coming into the season, and that's been a big part of his struggles. I get the reflex to say, well, then you can't wear an A. You can't wear a letter if that's how you're performing. On the other hand, the team has to be so focused on doing whatever it can to salvage the situation with Elias Pettersson.
Yeah, you don't want him answering questions about it, et cetera, et cetera.
That's the thing. And so if you, like me, believe that this is some mix of physical and mental, I don't think that's going to help the mental side of things. Well, I think there's a lot of other things you can do before something as dramatic and public as that.
I also, there's an element to which I think challenging people so that they have to step up into roles like, you know, we haven't been able to talk to him this week. We haven't really been able to talk to him since the Miller trade, frankly, right? Like Quinn Hughes hasn't actually talked to the Vancouver media since the Miller trade. He gave the interview to Murph, but since then he's been injured, right? So he hasn't practiced. He hasn't. So we actually haven't. But I promise you this, knowing Quinn Hughes, okay? Quinn Hughes is taking this very hard. I guarantee it. Not because... Not for like the reasons of like, I bet Quinn Hughes is miserable that they traded JT Miller. No, because Quinn Hughes knows that when he was made captain of this organization, there was going to be questions about whether or not he could do it. Just like there were questions about whether he could defend at his size. Just like there were questions about whether his shot was too much of a muffin to be a goal scoring threat in this league. Just, like Quinn Hughes hears doubters and it motivates him. It's fuel for him. And he takes this seriously and he takes it hard. And the fact that he was the captain of this team that imploded, I promise you, is something that he thinks reflects on him. Do we think it reflects on him? I'm actually asking. That's not rhetorical.
No, I don't.
I don't either.
It'd be really tough to sit up here and be like, man, how did Quinn Hughes let this happen?
And by the way, internally, no one has anything but praise for how Hughes handled a difficult situation. But I promise you, like, he actually said it himself, just not in these terms, where he said, I feel responsibility for the dysfunction.
Yeah, that's right.
And I promise you he means it, and that it goes a lot deeper than what was effectively like a boilerplate answer. Not that it wasn't honest. It was. It's just he didn't ruminate on it. He sort of dropped it and moved on to answering a different question. So, you know, I think the... Where did I start here? I've lost my train.
The leadership
thing.
Wearing an A.
Right. So I think that reflects that when this team sewed a C on Quinn Hughes' sweater, he felt a significant responsibility to step up. And, I think he felt that anyway. I think that's self-motivating. I think that he was always going to improve his game in terms of trying to become a better shooter and goal scorer and offensive threat and on and on. But I also do buy that, you know, there's an element to which putting the C on Quinn Hughes elicited the best version of him,
mm-hmm.
right? He was challenged to grow into a role and he rose to that challenge. But the act of challenging him also plays a role there? Well, you know, we've heard Bruce Boudreau discuss Elias Pettersson needing positive reinforcement, right? He's done it often on various hits. We know that this team's been very reluctant to have him, even when he was like deserving of it, which he isn't right now. I want to be clear, but has been reluctant to have him play matchup minutes, mm-hmm. to play the first line role, to get those with Hughes minutes, right? That was always loaded on JT. Taking key draws. He's been taking key draws. He's actually done pretty well in the faceoff circle since Miller left, but that's new, right? That's a new challenge that's being given to him. Killing penalties. Took him years to get on the penalty kill, right? So took him years to be out with the net empty at the end of games, right? At what point has this organization empowered him with a challenge the way they did with Quinn Hughes with the C? Now, you only get one letter. You only get to sew that on one player.
So. Yeah, but isn't... Like, he's part of the leadership group. And they signed him to an $11.6 million contract. Isn't that what you're getting at here?
Well, they signed
part
him,
of it.
They signed him to an $11.6 million contract after threatening to trade him and then continued to play him as a 2C.
But isn't that inherently, and Jim Rutherford has kind of said this, like, I told him it's going to get harder. Isn't that laying down the challenge, inviting the player to step up to the challenge of, hey, you're the highest paid forward in a Canadian market that has aspirations here?
I suppose, but most of our reaction when he signed that deal was, man, if he'd wanted to take this to the wire, he probably could have got more. Wasn't it?
Sure, but I still think, like, the act of...
Investment?
Investing in a player, like, giving him the richest contract in franchise history... That's pretty significant. Like, that is a significant challenge of, like, we are counting on you. Even if, hey, you're not matching up with Nathan MacKinnon, but you don't give a player that deal unless you're sending the message of, like, we are challenging you.
Yeah, and money talks. So I accept what you're saying, but I also think that the way hockey guys often think, where, like, you know, not that our paycheck doesn't matter and doesn't reflect, you know, our standing in the league and who we are, but... There's more to it in terms of what my role is, what my challenge is, my ability to compete with the best in the league, whether I'm empowered to do so. You know, usage-wise anyway, I think this organization's spent Pettersson's entire career spoon-feeding him. And is that reflective of what he's been prepared for? I think it's something that he's bucked against the entire way. I know he did under Travis Green. Bruce Boudreau opened the, you know, opened the door and... Whatever you want, right? Whatever you want. And that was his best hockey. Right now, he played really well under Rick Tocchet for the first 85 games that he played for him. But and then you get into this moment where he doesn't warrant that type of opportunity. And yet, I do think him not getting it is also an issue. Certainly, you can't strip him of an A at this point. Positivity. Make it work with him. Your partner's in winning with Elias Pettersson until you're not. Until you make the decision that you're not.
Yeah.
You have to view it that way.
And I think even beyond just positivity, I get what you're saying about ask more of him, right? Like, raise the standard. But that's what they should be saying here. Like, hey, you're our guy now. We traded JT Miller. You're wearing an A. You're part of the leadership group. We believe in your talent. We want you to be one of the faces of this franchise, one of the leaders publicly, internally, going forward. Now, it's one thing to say that and lay that out to the player. You also have to figure out a path forward on that plan that works for him, right? That works for the team as well. Because the problem is, okay, hey, he wants those first line minutes. He wants to be in that matchup role, all of that. You can't play him like that right now. You're in a playoff race. And we were talking about it earlier in the game. What he was giving you against San Jose was fourth line level stuff, like fringe fourth line level stuff. So there has to be, like, I hear what you're saying, that the team can probably go about managing this relationship in a different way. And maybe part of that is amping up the responsibility on Elias Pettersson, but it is a two-way street. Like, his play has to demand and earn that extra responsibility at a certain point too.
Yes. Yeah, no, it does. And right now, especially. Like, he needs to have a big game on
against
Saturday.
Toronto tomorrow.
Well,
that would go a long way.
He needs to bounce back from whatever that was in San Jose. Like, that was such a brutal game for that line.
It really was. It was awful.
Hey, let me give you an example, by the way. I know he isn't in one of his purple goal scoring patches, so maybe this is just me. But don't you think Jake DeBrusk has had his most noticeable and assertive week in terms of the checking, the puck carrying across the last 3-4 games?
Yeah, I don't know.
I think it's pronounced.
So you mean in terms of everything other than goal scoring, basically? Well, right, because he's not scoring goals right now.
Because the team's not scoring goals, yeah. Let's be real.
Yeah, I've noticed it a little bit more.
I think it's super noticeable. I just think there's, you know, and again, that's not a JT Miller was holding Jake DeBrusk back. That's not what I'm saying. But naturally, when you create a vacuum in a team,
people step up to fill it.
They have to step up to fill it. And I just think you're seeing that out of DeBrusk, and it's just an example of sort of what I'm talking about, where it's like you, when elite talent meets elite opportunity, that's when you're cooking. And there's elite opportunity here. To some extent, anyway, I do think across the last 4 or 5 years, there's been a trend of the Canucks not pushing Pettersson into the deep end of the pool, right? And instead, you know, making sure he's in the shallow end.
Getting him the water wings, yeah.
And now it's like, well, now you don't want him. I don't know if he can swim all over the deep end, but there have been times where it's been odd.
Yeah, it's one of those questions, right, where it's like once your confidence is so shot,
right,
or whatever's going on, or the physical, like, and you're playing down to the lowered bar, how do you even start raising the bar again if it's just going to set up more failure? And again, as Woodley said earlier, like, there's people making a lot more money than us who are struggling to figure this out, so we're not going to come to any firm conclusions here, but again, just a baffling situation all around. Do you have, like, a one or two favorite prop bets that you want to run by us here in the last couple minutes for the Super Bowl?
Oh, sure. Here's what I'm on. You ready?
Okay.
Love to go.
I am so ready.
Love to go over my bets.
I know. What a gift I've just given you.
Thank you so much. Here's the thing I like most. I like Patrick Mahomes. He's 36.5 pass attempts.
Okay.
I think the fundamental dynamic of this game is going to be Eagles can run the ball and Chiefs can't. Okay, no way the Chiefs are going to be able to consistently run the ball against this Eagles defense. I expect they'll run a bit on early downs, mostly to stop guys like Nolan Smith jumping the snap count, but that's it. It's going to be just run enough to keep them honest. And so I think with the Eagles defense being a real monster, I think the Chiefs are going to have to rely on quick game. So I like Mahomes rushing attempts over two, but I really like passing attempts over. I don't think they're going to be able to hunt explosives. I think they're going to have to dink and dunk their way down the field with Mahomes just orchestrating and avoiding mistakes. So I like him. I like him at 36.5. I like him at 40.
Okay,
I like him at 45. Okay, I like him at
45.
Dude, he regularly hits 46 over the last 4 or 5 weeks. Like, it's actually massively underpriced.
Oh, sorry, rushing yards.
No, I'm talking pass attempts.
Pass attempt. 46 pass attempts?
46 dropbacks is not outrageous. Sorry, it's 36.5 is the prop now.
Yeah.
But it's not uncommon for him to hit mid-40s.
All right.
They've had to do this a lot, especially against good defenses, and I think they'll have to do it. I really like Devontae Smith stuff. I'm a little nervous about Goddard stuff, but I like, even though the Chiefs are really bad against tight ends, they're a bit of a tight end funnel. But a second cornerback is a weak spot for the Chiefs, and I think they're going to have to play in man a lot because they're going to load up to, they're going to cheat to stop Saquon Barkley. If that happens, Devontae Smith's going to cook. I like him for most receptions. You can get that at plus 650. And then,
yeah, 650 all the way.
And then I like to sprinkle on longest reception because it's effectively random.
Yeah.
But the Chiefs are especially fun to do it with because you know at some point they're going to have odd fourth and fifth receivers who are every bit as likely to catch the 35-yarder as their biggest name guys. Justin Watson, longest reception, plus 4,000. Juju Smith-Schuster, plus 2,000, longest reception. I like those a lot.
There you go. That is Drance's Super Bowl props preview. Enjoy the Canucks game. Enjoy the Super Bowl. We're back on Monday. Be a little different. We'll do a little hybrid Canucks talk and Four Nations talk for the next couple of weeks, covering that tournament as well as anything that's cropping up around the Canucks in that time. So have a great weekend. We're back on Monday here on Sportsnet 650.